From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. As the clock runs down on the presidential race, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are both campaigning today in the key states of Minnesota and Wisconsin. And here are some interesting facts. Minnesota hasn't voted for a Republican since 1972, but the last election there, Hillary Clinton's victory was razor thin. She won by just 44,000 votes. And in the neighboring Wisconsin, President Trump won by only 23,000 votes.
And look what's going on in Texas. The state has already collected more votes this year than it did in 2016. And with a flood of ballots coming in, the question in some key states is, will they all be counted? Just last night, a federal appeals court ruled that any late arriving absentee ballots in Minnesota must be separated out in case another court rules they can be counted. They can't be counted after Election Day. Nearly 400,000 requested ballots in Minnesota haven't been turned in yet. Let's bring in our political roundtable. Jesse Holland is a host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal, and Beth Fooey is senior politics editor at NBC News. Both are on a Skype line, and welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And at dueling events in Florida yesterday, Trump and Biden criticized each other's handling of the coronavirus. Trump said Biden would shut down the country again.
There will be no school, no graduations, no weddings, no Thanksgivings, no Christmases, no 4th of July's. There will be nothing. They will allow you nothing. Other than that, he's doing a wonderful job.
And Biden said this.
I'm not going to shut down the economy. I'm not going to shut down the country, but I'm going to shut down the virus.
Beth, what's your take on how both men are approaching the final days of the campaign?
Well, President Trump is on the wrong side of public opinion on this one. Poll after poll after poll shows that this is the number one issue for most voters. Voters are very worried about getting sick. They're worried about their friends or family getting sick. They feel that President Trump has not been a responsible steward of this crisis. And that's what's weighing him down, quite frankly, Peter. Had he taken a responsible approach to this last February, March, when it was first coming to this country and stepped forward and said he was a wartime president, that he would manage this like a war. He would marshal the resources of the federal government to fight this virus. If he put on a mask, if he encouraged people to wear a mask, he would probably be cruising to reelection right now. In fact, he took the opposite approach, and that is why polling across the country is showing him struggling.
Well, and Jesse, what do you think about that? Because the worst coronavirus outbreak in the country right now is right there in the upper Midwest, where both men really need to win.
One of the things that we're seeing here is a completely two different opposite ways of trying to win the presidency. President Trump is trying to win the presidency by actually campaigning against his own time as president. He's saying he's still saying he's going to make America great. He's still saying that if Joe Biden is elected, America will continue the way it is right now during his presidency, with people out of work, with people getting sick from the coronavirus. Joe Biden is trying to win the presidency by saying he is going to do the exact opposite of what President Trump is doing. He's going to work with the scientists. He's going to work against the virus. He's not going to go out on his own and try to make the American people feel better by just saying things are better. He's actually going to do things. So we see one candidate trying to run against the things that happened while he was in office, and another candidate running to change the things that happened while his opponent was in office. The question is, as always with these elections, who turns out on election day? Who's voting before the election day, and how and whether those votes will be counted?
Yeah, I'm hearing what both of you all are saying, Jesse and Beth. I want to ask you, though, I want to parse out more the ground game of both of these candidates, along with the things that they're saying. So The Atlantic has an article today about how President Trump could actually win Minnesota because he has a door-knocking campaign there despite the pandemic, as well as micro-targeting Latino voters in key states. And Politico reports how some Democrats in Florida, for instance, have been tearing their hair out trying to get Biden folks to actually door-knock there, which he hasn't done in part because of the pandemic. Beth, will this be what we'll be talking about on Wednesday if Trump wins, for instance?
So the Biden campaign made a strategic calculation early on that in these days of coronavirus and people staying in their homes and not venturing out much, the last thing they want is a stranger knocking on their door to talk to them about politics. Now, that approach changed a little bit in the last, I'd say, you know, 5-6 weeks. There has been a little bit more sort of traditional door-to-door canvassing by the Biden team, but they are really largely abiding by that first principle that this is just not a year where people want strangers showing up at the door. And yeah, so we'll see whether this was the right calculation on the Biden part's campaign. I mean, obviously, President Trump wants to downplay the virus, has said it's going away, that it's not that serious. If you get it, you're going to recover. So, you know, it's very much in keeping with that message that the campaign is deploying all these door knockers. You know, we're in uncharted territory here. Traditionally, a good ground game does can make up a point or two in a in a closely fought race. And we will see what happens this time.
Jesse, I want to talk to you for a second about this targeting and micro-targeting. So the pandemic, as we know, has disproportionately hit Black Americans. The recession has disproportionately hit working women. There's social unrest that President Trump is exploiting. And Biden has this inconsistent history with both groups. Where are Black voters and women in the final days? Of course, knowing they're not a monolith.
Here's the thing that a lot of us who follow politics are not taking into account as we come to the last days. A large population of the voting Americans out there have already voted. So if you were waiting for the last 2 days or the last 5 days of the election to start your micro-targeting campaign, you've missed more than, 50, 60 million voters already, people who've already gone to the ballots. And we've seen that targeting. We've seen the targeting aimed toward African Americans. Well, a lot of African Americans have already voted. If people are waiting to do their dirty tricks on the day of the election, they're going to miss the population that's normally targeted for those dirty tricks, because the African American voters, a lot of them have already voted in Georgia, in Texas, in Mississippi, all around the South. Those populations, and including in the big urban centers, they've been standing in line for days to get their votes out before they get targeted by those dirty tricks in the elections. So I don't know how much these last second appeals by even Joe Biden or President Trump is going to make a difference in those populations, because a lot of them have already voted.
Jesse, you say dirty tricks. It makes me wonder if you see security issues at polling places affecting the vote at all.
Well, one of the things that we've seen, and I actually had a caller talk about this on C-SPAN a couple of weeks ago, that when he got ready to vote, they were insisting that they had to take his temperature before he voted. So some of the things that might seem reasonable in a pandemic also could be ways to tamp down the voting population. So we know that a lot of voters are being targeted on social media. We know that in some states they have people talking about they're going to be there with guns on voting day to monitor the population. So we've seen conversations about a lot of this, but we've also seen a lot of voting populations show up and vote early, so they won't even be affected by these things. And I think that's going to be a wave of the future where people don't wait for Election Day, and that'll make it harder for their vote to be suppressed.
Beth, I mentioned at the top that some votes that come in a little bit late may not end up even being counted. There's an ongoing fight over absentee ballots in Minnesota, also in Pennsylvania, of course. What kind of conflict ahead do you see there after November 3rd?
Yeah, the Supreme Court has weighed in on a number of states' rules around this. And they've, you know, on the one hand, let mail-in voting continue counting of mail-in ballots continue after November 3rd in some states. In others, they've seemed to have put the brakes on. It really depends on how close this is. I mean, we could face a scenario where the vote is so close that we are waiting for mail-in balloting in battleground states across the country. And that definitely portends a very close race, and those mail-in ballots are going to matter a lot. But there's a chance, as Jesse said, because of this enormous early turnout and what we're expecting to be a very large turnout on Election Day as well, that these mail-in ballots will not be determinative of the winner of the election. But if things look close on Tuesday, states like Pennsylvania, North Carolina, their mail-in ballots really could make a difference.
Yeah, and kind of delve into that a little bit. I mean, people are thinking, okay, so what state should I be watching on election night, knowing that it could take quite a while before we actually get the results? What are some key states that you will really be focused on, including the ones you just mentioned?
So the number one state to be focused on is Florida. Their polling places closed fairly early, and they also have a very long history of dealing with mail-in ballots. They count them very quickly. So we will get a sense of how the direction that Florida has gone fairly early in the evening. And Florida will tell us a lot. It would be very hard for President Trump to win if he loses Florida. Joe Biden can continue on, and there's other paths to 270 for him should he lose Florida. But if President Trump loses Florida, it is going to be a hard march for him.
That's Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC. And Jesse Holland is a host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Schools across the country are back in session, with some reporting outbreaks of COVID-19 that have forced them to temporarily shut down. We asked two teachers to tell us about their experiences in the classroom during a pandemic, starting with Sydney Jensen, a ninth grade English teacher at Lincoln High School in Lincoln, Nebraska. Sydney, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. And did I see you're also the 2019 Teacher of the Year in Nebraska?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, so we have an all-star on our hand. Congratulations.
I don't know about that, but thank you.
Yeah, sure. And then we've also got Dan Cranford, no slouch, a special education teacher at the Eastern North Carolina School for the Deaf in Wilson, North Carolina. Dan, welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. It's my pleasure, Peter. And Sydney, congratulations on Teacher of the Year.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
All righty. Well, I want to give you each a chance to tell me how you're doing, because this school year is one like no other. How's it going? Sydney, start with you.
To be honest, not awesome. This has definitely been the hardest year of teaching that I've ever experienced. This is, I think, year 8 for me in the profession. I've always really loved getting up and going to work every morning. And this year is the first year that I find myself really experiencing that teacher burnout that people talk about. I ask myself a lot of days how much longer I can do this. And that is not something that I'm used to.
Tell me why. I mean, I know we're in just a wild time right now, but what's making it so hard?
So, you know, we're doing sort of a hybrid instruction model at Lincoln High. So teachers are in person every single day. And then we have our students divided into multiple groups. And so a lot of it is workload that's really, you know, tripled in most respects. I'm also 27 weeks pregnant, and so that has added some added challenges and stress, just worrying. I'm very nervous about getting the virus, and what does that mean for pregnancy? It's exhausting to feel that level of anxiety all day, every day.
Well, hold that thought, Sydney, because it does sound absolutely exhausting. But I want Dan to come in here and, you know, tell me how you're doing, Dan. Is what you're hearing, aside from the pregnancy part of it, I mean, is what you're hearing from Sydney something you can relate with?
Well, in my situation, I'm at a residential school, so our students come in on Sunday evenings and stay with us through the week, and they leave on Friday afternoons. The staff come back and forth, though. We test all of our students before they get on transportation. We test them when they come into the building. We test them in the mornings, and I test them again in the evenings. The staff is tested when we come in the mornings. And that's one way we're dealing with the COVID. As far as being in classroom, we're under Plan B, which we do 6 feet apart, of course. I had to move half my desk out of the room. If you're asking me how I'm doing with it, if we're following the protocols, we seem to be having a pretty successful year so far. And, of course, I'm dealing with students, so they naturally want to be around each other, and they have to keep their mask on, and they have to stay 6 feet apart.
Dan, are you feeling the same kind of burnout as Sydney?
I'm feeling the extra heavier workload. Yes. It's harder. And half my students I'm still teaching online. So I'll have a classroom where I have kids on a display. They're at home, but I also have students in the classroom. And so I'm trying to navigate both at the same time.
Yeah, well, as you all both well know, many teachers have retired or quit because they just didn't want to go back into the classroom. I wonder if either of you ever had a moment of reflecting on what you wanted from your future and maybe digging in your heels and saying, no way, I can't go back.
I love what I do every day, and I really consider it a privilege that, you know, I get to work with the kids that I do every single day. I think I teach the best kids in the world. And so that's never really been a question. There's certainly have been fears of, you know, are we making the right decisions as a district? We've had a lot of adjustments to our plan and our protocol, and the effectiveness is sort of still in question, I think, with what we've done. You know, we also have kids. We're trying to space out as best we can, but with class sizes, 6 feet apart isn't really feasible. And even with the like 50% in person each day, kids are about 4 feet apart at best. We bleach the desks between every period. We, you know, have to give out hand sanitizer at the start of each class. Students and staff all wear masks every day, all day. But even with that, you know, our most recent numbers that the district released, in our district, we've had over 200 student positives. We've had almost 150 staff positives of the virus. We just had what they're saying is the first real confirmed case of school spread.
So do you feel safe?
No.
Sydney, if you don't feel safe, why are you going to work?
Because I love my kids. And, you know, I think that teachers, in a lot of ways, we really sign up for a certain level of risk when we agree to do the job. Of course, I care about their learning and their ability to, like, grow into these, like, awesome citizens that they are and that they continue to become after they leave Lincoln High. And I love being a part of that growth and that journey for them. I can't see myself doing anything else. And I'm also just hopeful that this will end, that there will be a light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, aren't we all? Dan, I want to ask you how the kids are doing. How is their learning going? Like, I was wondering with my own kids, because in the spring, no one really knew what was happening with this pandemic. No one had figured out how to do online learning all that well. And now we're in the fall and things are still not great. And I just wonder, like, how much ground kids might have lost in that time. Have you seen any of that in the kids at your school?
I'm sure Sydney has, and I have as well, noticed this regression from them not physically being into the school. You know, students learn best when they're physically in the school, especially younger students. I deal with middle school and high school students. And there was a lot of regression. We went out in March, and we didn't come back until August. And I'm worried about a lost year for a lot of our kids. You're doing a lot of rebuilding.
Yeah. Well, and Dan, I know you said that you're seeing anxiety and depression in your students. Tell me about that.
I see students who are fearful. Because I teach deaf kids, a lot of my kids are like tuning forks. They can sense that when things aren't right. What I'm sensing is they're dealing with it. They're trying to learn at the same time dealing with emotional issues. And it's making for a difficult learning experience for them, a difficult teaching experience for Sydney and I know.
I can imagine. So, Sydney, I want to leave this last question with you. What do you need from parents, from your students, from administrators that would make your life easier, your classroom safer?
That's a great question, and I don't know if I have a perfect answer for it. I think that the biggest thing that everyone needs right now is grace. I think everybody's having a hard time. Teachers are, parents are, as they're trying to adjust to, you know, child care needs on these days when their students are remote. Our students are highly stressed out, sort of like what Dan said. I think that there's an emotional toll that's being taken by not being able to smile at their classmates. One thing I've noticed is in, you know, years past, teachers are sort of always fighting the like crosstalk, you know, kids giggling with the student next to them. And now I crave it. Like, I wish that kids were, were crosstalking, and having those like funny moments together that interrupt my teaching. I sort of miss that. I think that the biggest thing to remember is that everybody's struggling and everybody's doing the best that they can. We're all under significant pressure. We're all still trying to build the plane while we fly it and figure out ways to reach our students remotely that are going to be effective and engaging, ways to build connections with our students who are in front of us when we can't share a smile with them. And even though we're, you know, 7 months into this pandemic, it's going to be a long haul to figure out how to make school and relationships and connections continue to thrive and function at a high level.
I agree with Sydney, Peter, and Sydney, but I also want to say that I'm an optimist at heart. And I feel that if you're going to have optimism, it's got to be a teacher. I mean, we got to show a positive and optimistic face every day to these kids and let them know this is a problem. But we're going to get over it. We're going to get over it together. And we can't just crawl under the hole. We got to teach through our examples of optimism and how to move forward in an appropriate and smart way.
Well, I am glad, Dan, that somebody can be an optimist in this time. Dan Cranford, special education teacher at the Eastern North Carolina School for the Deaf, and Sydney Jensen, ninth grade English teacher at Lincoln High School in Lincoln, Nebraska. I am so thankful for what both of you do every single day. Hang in there. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Peter, and thank you, Sydney, and good luck, Sydney.
Thank you all so much. It was great to talk to you.
More than 300,000 people are still without power in Louisiana as of this morning after Hurricane Zeta ripped across the Gulf Coast on Wednesday and left 6 people dead. Emergency crews are busy today trying to assess the damage and restore power. The storm has weakened, but it's also dumped heavy rain as far away as New Jersey. Joining us on Skype is Times-Picayune reporter Bryn Stoll. Bryn, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
Sure. And in the Barrier Island community of Grand Isle, the levee system broke in 3 places in this storm. Governor John Bel Edwards called the damage catastrophic. What does the damage look like from where you are?
So here in New Orleans, we've got a lot of tree limbs down all over the place, some basic damage to structures, a couple of buildings collapsed, nothing too terrible. Some siding was ripped off of my house, and I have a little bit of a leak in my roof. But the biggest thing is that there's massive power outages. Grand Isle got hit particularly hard because this is about, I think, the 5th hurricane to hit Louisiana this hurricane season. And they had some massive erosion to those levees in earlier storms. And so this one was just sort of the cherry on top for them.
Yeah. And as you say, 300,000 people still without power in Louisiana. The storm hit Wednesday, so it's been a while now. You know, what are the barriers to getting those lights back on?
Well, the blackouts stretch from here in Louisiana all the way into Georgia. So it is, I mean, it's a massive project to try to get those back up. Several main transmission lines were knocked down, you know, trees tearing down power lines or the power poles themselves just getting snapped. So there's, I think, about almost 5,000 linemen from all over the country who are here in Louisiana working to get power back up. But it's a pretty complicated process, and it's pretty expensive, and it's difficult work. So you got to clear those trees out, you have to reestablish the transmission lines, and then you have to try to repair the distribution network. And so there's still about half the people in the New Orleans metro area still don't have power.
Well, and we see that it could take up to 10 days for some people to get power back, which means they won't have power on election day, a big election coming up. What kind of damage has there been to election infrastructure, polling places, that sort of thing?
They are still assessing that. That was one of the big concerns is obviously within the 10 days will be election day. Before the storm hit, the state shared with the power companies a list of all the polling places in the area to try to prioritize restoring power to those places, alongside other critical infrastructure like hospitals, water infrastructure, fire stations, that kind of thing. Whether that happens, I think the power companies are pretty optimistic that they can pull that off. But if they can't, there's a bunch of contingencies being kicked around, including using the NBA arena where the Pelicans play here in New Orleans as a super precinct to move Election Day voting, getting generators out to all the precincts all over the city to try to make it work. Obviously, it gets a little complicated because you have to communicate those changes to people. And so that's one of the things that people are worried about. If power is not restored in time, whether there might be mass confusion on Election Day about where people are supposed to be casting ballots.
Well, not only that, all of this is happening in the middle of a pandemic. As you said, this has been a long hurricane season for Louisiana. People must be exhausted there, yourself included. Times-Picayune reporter Bryn Stoll, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
No, thanks for your interest. I appreciate it.
Survivors of COVID-19 and their families are gathering outside of the South Carolina State House in Columbia today to grieve those who have died during the pandemic. Summer Barrios of Seneca, South Carolina, is part of that remembrance. Her husband, Robert, is thankfully alive, but he is still navigating long-term health complications after testing positive for COVID in July. And Robert is home now after 81 days in the hospital and a rehab stay. And his journey has been hard on the family's overall health as well as their finances. Summer, welcome to Here and Now.
I appreciate y'all having me on.
Your husband, Robert, is 46 years old, and we understand he's having trouble talking after this COVID-19 diagnosis. How is he doing?
He had a trach, and so he has some scarring in the throat, and he's still on supplemental oxygen here at home. So he gets, you know, he's struggling still, but we're just grateful to have him home.
His lungs are only operating at about 50% capacity right now. He could have lung disease brought on by damage from COVID-19. Your husband was a warehouse manager doing shipping and receiving when he got sick. Can you take us back to that time? How did you find out?
It was the last Monday of June, beginning of July. Was just hanging out around the house and everything. And then Monday he got up real early to go to work. A few hours later, calls me incredibly sick. We're lucky he even made it home, because if you were to, anybody was to talk to him now, he would tell you that he really doesn't remember any part of July, including that day. His illness, you know, just literally came out of nowhere. And it was definitely a long 81 days.
What was his experience like in the hospital?
He was on a ventilator four times, the last one being a trach. He experienced ICU delirium, had a collapsed lung, aspirated multiple times, which also caused bacterial pneumonia. One morning, Tuesday or Wednesday of the first week he was there, he called me really early in the morning crying. Excuse me, it's kind of hard to relive this. Crying, saying that he was going to be ventilated. That was the first of four times.
Oh, Summer, this is so hard. I'm so sorry.
Well, you know, we're just blessed to have him home. You know, unlike so many other people that have lost someone, you know, our hearts, you know, definitely go out to them.
How long have you all been married?
Actually, October 16th was our 10-year wedding anniversary. So he was actually out in time for that, which we were very blessed to have a chapel here in the Clemson area to let us do a vow renewal. I went from before he got sick to just us being, you know, happy and cautious and doing what the medical professionals suggested to having to think about his funeral. And then when he finally came out, the vow renewal was definitely not the first thing on my mind. It was protecting him and protecting our immune compromised daughter. You know, so we were blessed that people stepped up to help us make that happen.
In light of all of this, though, I mean, it's also been financially hard. This has not been an easy road for you and for many of the other families. You're a one-income household. Robert was your sole provider. How have you been getting by?
Well, you know, at the beginning, when he first went in, you know, we kept in touch with his employer and stuff and his boss, and he had 40 hours of what's called COVID pay, and that was basically just a week, you know, worth of pay. And then after that, we were lucky enough to find out that he had short-term disability through his work, and that is $300 a week. It runs out basically at the end of December, which is really hard, you know, for just about anybody to live on, let alone somebody that has now two medically complex people at home. Still, of course, have bills coming in, including medical now. You know, like you know, his lung function was at right around 50%. And in middle of December, we're supposed to go, he's supposed to go back to do another one to see if there's any progress, if any. We're possibly looking at the diagnosis of restrictive lung disease brought on by the COVID damage and the double pneumonia.
Your 12-year-old daughter, Jessica, is there with you. Can I say hello?
Yeah, sure.
Hello.
Hi, Jessica. This is Tanya. How are you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
I am doing okay. I'm happy to talk to you. How have you been? How have things been like for you? Life?
Well, it's been much easier since, you know, he came home, and it was hard for all of us, you know, just thinking, you know, he's sick, put on ventilator for 4 times, you know.
Yeah. What's your dad like? What's your relationship like with your dad?
Well, I'm pretty much a daddy-daughter girl with him. We have, you know, we have a really good relationship, so any time he can always make you laugh, you know.
What would you say to other kids out there who they know about COVID-19, but maybe they don't think it's a big deal, or they're just not directly impacted like you have been impacted? What's kind of the message you would like to say to them?
I would say, you know, it's good to wear a mask and, you know, social distance, because one day this could be you, you know. You never know when your life could be perfect 1 minute and crazy the next, basically.
Yeah. Jessica, is it true your 12th birthday was also the same day as your parents' wedding anniversary?
Yeah, it was. I was so happy for him to come home before my birthday.
Yeah. How did you guys celebrate?
We went for a little dinner, then birthday cake, presents, stuff like that.
Yeah, I know it probably felt so good to be able to have him there, even though he's pretty sick still.
Yeah, the main part I really liked is him being home and at least strong enough to be there with us.
Jessica, thank you for talking to me. I really appreciate it. Can I have your mom back?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, Jessica.
Okay, I'm back.
You know, hearing her speak about this, thinking about everything that you're going through, how is this all influencing how you're feeling about who should be leading this country through COVID-19? Of course, that's on the minds of all of us right now. We're just a few days out from the election.
Well, I know both of my husband and my opinion on that has changed, especially after COVID hitting so hard at home. My husband was a Trump supporter prior to him getting sick. But when he came out and was watching the news when Trump came out and said that he had COVID, and, you know, he did the little walkthrough and everything, both of our opinions on who we were going to vote for definitely went to the Democratic side. We just hope whoever wins, whether it be Trump or Biden, that people start listening to the medical professionals that are in power and not to the political, because we, like my daughter said, we know how fast COVID can destroy a life. We hope that both Congress as well as whoever has the presidency really starts listening and realizing that, you know, the once frontline workers are now the ones that are fighting COVID and are, like my husband, you know, just forgotten by the administration.
You're part of a group called COVID Survivors for Change. So I wonder, what exactly do you want to see changed when it comes to how our country is managing this pandemic?
I do believe that this should be a bipartisan, you know, issue where everybody comes together for the sake of this country and for, you know, to honor the ones that have passed needlessly from this virus.
Summer, I really appreciate you taking this time with all that you're going through and with your family to share your story with us.
Well, I appreciate you having us on.
That was Summer Barrios talking to us about her husband Robert's long-haul journey with COVID-19 and how it's impacting their family's health and finances. We also heard from their 12-year-old daughter, Jessica.
Pennsylvania is one of the most important of the contested states in this election. But with one key demographic, the race doesn't appear to be very close. A new ABC News Washington Post poll finds that 59% of women in Pennsylvania's suburbs say they support Democratic candidate Joe Biden. 41% say they support Trump. And it was in Pennsylvania just a few weeks ago when President Trump said this.
Please, please. Suburban women, you should love me, you know, because somebody said I'm not doing that well with suburban women. I said, why? Last time.
In 2016, Trump narrowly won the state, but Hillary Clinton took Bucks County, home to some of Philadelphia's suburbs. And political experts say Bucks County may lean blue again this year, thanks to women. Here and now, Shiko Thayuri reports.
You can't help but fall in love with Bucks County's beautiful windy roads, some shaded with massive trees that arch over, showing their fall foliage. And there are rural areas, too, with long front yards and rolling hills. And in the neighborhoods, you can't help but notice the diversity of political signs. It's pretty hard to tell how this part of the state leans. Doylestown is the seat of Bucks County. It was the last stop of a pro-Trump parade that clashed with Biden supporters demonstrating in a women's march a few weeks ago. The political parity here is pretty clear. Just head to West State Street. That's where you'll find Shannon Lely. I met her outside of her shop called Planet Smoothie.
I am voting for Trump.
Lely is a Republican mom of four, and this will be her second time voting for Trump. She plans to do so in person on Election Day, and Lely says she didn't know Trump was even calling on women like her to support him. And while she admits that Trump's behavior and rhetoric haven't always been exemplary, she says he's better than the alternative.
Biden is completely fake, and I can't even stand it when he was like, oh, people of America. So I'd rather somebody who's just real than fake, because you don't know what's going on behind the facade.
But she says it's really Trump's policies that have her vote.
It doesn't matter what Trump says, like as much as the whole party of what they stand for.
As a Christian, Lely says she's anti-abortion and pleased with the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court. Barrett is expected to chip away at Roe versus Wade. And as a small business owner, Lely says she's benefited from Trump's tax policy. Karen Stone says she's also benefited from Trump's economic policies. She's a Democrat, voting for Joe Biden, and works at a boutique nearby. It's a cozy, modern shop with sleek hardwood floors. But Stone says despite Trump's economic policies,
that's not a reason to vote for him.
Stone says she's voted for candidates outside of her party before and considered giving Trump the opportunity to change her mind until recently.
The way he handled himself during the first debate, I wanted to give him a chance, thought maybe things could change for the better, but that hasn't happened.
We've seen suburban Philadelphia become increasingly Democratic after a century plus of being Republican.
That's Christopher Borick. He's the director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. He says Bucks County has deep Republican roots, but it's overwhelmingly white. It's also more educated and wealthier, which is why it's become more politically competitive. And Borg says suburban women are a cohort of voters that are capable of moving the needle.
We've seen that group move increasingly during the Trump years to Democratic positions. They've shown that in their vote during midterm elections and state elections. They've shown it in polls. And it's a group that the president and Republicans can't afford to lose much more ground in. And I think you've seen them lose ground relatively to where they were in 2016. And thus you see the efforts to rhetorically reach out and to try to find policy areas, including law and order, as an in to this group.
And that message of law and order has resonated with Shannon Lully, the owner of the smoothie shop in Doylestown.
I know there is absolutely still racism in this country. Like, I do not deny that. But when cops are coming into my store scared for their life now, that's not okay. Like, so when you disrespect and you have no respect for authority, we are going to crumble, especially youth. Like, youth have no respect for authority anymore. And this whole thing is just fueling that. And when there's no respect for authority, there's no respect for private property. I mean, businesses being smashed in. Like, who pays for that?
But Lully is in the minority here. A recent Reuters Ipsos poll found only 11% of white people in suburbs across the country consider civil unrest and Trump's tough on crime stance to be a major issue. We'll have to wait and see if President Trump continues to make his plea to suburban women. He's expected back in Bucks County tomorrow, looking to secure enough votes to make a difference in this crucial swing state. For Here and Now, I'm Shiko Thiuri.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. The candidates make their final pitches before Tuesday's election, with record early voting amid the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll have the latest next time on Here and Now.